the Chancellor, Deputy Vice-Chancellor, eminent persons, members of the university community. I know that the chairperson gave you all the details so you could tweet. But my request is that you shut your cell phones and tweet later. I hope this can be an hour, 2 hours of direct engagement between us. I'm glad to be a part of the marketplace. I hope to be an active participant. But in a way which I hope can make of the marketplace what the Greeks used to call the intellectual agora, a marketplace of ideas. We also have something to bring to society which is nowadays referred to as market, so long as we are in the market. We have views on how we should relate to one another. The South Sudan referendum was publicized as a great moment of self-determination. And indeed, a great moment it was, if we recognize that not every people gets this opportunity. Not even every generation gets this opportunity. If self-determination comes to a people, it comes once in several generations. And it comes at a great price. And that price is no less than political violence. So many have died to make this moment of self-determination possible. So let's begin by acknowledging this sacrifice. The sacrifice that signifies this moment as historic. But I don't intend this talk to be a celebration. My objective is more analytical. My objective is to pose a set of questions, not with a view to answering them here and now, but with a view to setting in motion a discussion, with a view to putting forward some guidelines on how we may think of South Sudan in the days and months ahead. I think I'll need that bottle. In a political sense, self-determination is a moment of the founding of a new political order. Let's remember that in 1956, when Sudan became independent, That year was understood as the year of self-determination. Except that the self in the self-determination was Sudan. In 2011, the self in self-determination is South Sudan. I say this to make one point. The self is not permanent. The self is a historical self. Unlike what nationalists would have us think, the self is not eternal. It's not metaphysical. It changes over time. When we think of the history of the self, meaning the history of the nation, we tend to think of it as in some ways divinely written, as in some ways a given. History is always written from the standpoint of the present. Although we say history is a record of the past, history is really a biography that the present gives itself. And when the present changes, history changes too. The history that Sudan wrote in 1956 is different from the history that South Sudan will write in 2011. I'm going to focus on four questions in this talk. The first question is, how should those committed to Pan-African unity understand the emergence of a new state, an independent South Sudan? What does it teach us? What does it teach us, Pan-Africanists, about the process, the political process of creating unity? That's the first question. The second question, as we write the history of self-determination, as we write that history from the vantage point of the present, from an independent South Sudan, how shall we write the history of relations between North and the South? Shall we write it as a history of colonialism? Or shall we write it in a larger context? Third, how did the SPLA, historically a champion of unity of Sudan, come to demand an independent state? I assume all of you know that the SPLA was established in opposition to those who called for an independent South Sudan. How do we understand that the SPLA is the midwife of an independent South Sudan? And finally, now that the SPLA's political project has changed, now that its political project is to create a new state, this shift raises a different question. Will the South establish a new political order, a different political order, different from the one created after 1956 in Sudan? Or will it reproduce a version of the old political order, of the old state? Will independence lead to peace? Or will peace turn out to be an interlude in a conflict-ridden, ongoing present? So these are the four questions I wish to talk about in the next. I've been given 40 minutes. Professors are paid by the hour. Press the button, they speak for an hour. But I'll try and make it less. Although I must tell you, I'm not being paid for this. But habit. We often say that imperialism divided the continent. That's ABC of Pan-Africanists. I suggest we rethink this proposition. Historically, empires have united peoples, not divided them. The French created two great political units in Africa, French Equatorial Africa, French West Africa. Britain created two great federations, the Central African Federation, the East African Federation, and it created Sudan. These great political units split up, but that division did not come at the moment of colonialism. It came at the moment of independence. For one reason, the people who lived in these units saw these political arrangements as so many shackles, and they struggled to break free of them. Like the self, the nation that I talked about earlier, unity too does not develop in a linear fashion. Linear meaning in a straightforward fashion, like a straight line, going from bottom to up. It doesn't develop in a formulaic fashion for one reason. Political unity is the outcome of political struggle. Political unity is not and cannot be a result of utopian blueprints. Anyone interested in unity must recognize the importance of politics and persuasion, and thus the inevitability of a non-linear process. What I mean by this is the following. Unity can be created by different means, even contradictory means. It can be created by force, or it can be created by choice, which is why we need to distinguish between different kinds of unity. Unity through bondage and unity through freedom. This is why a democratic position on the question of African unity is not necessarily incompatible with a democratic position on the right of separation. Take an example. Just as the democratic right to union in a marriage is not incompatible with a democratic right to divorce. In fact, you would say that the only way to strengthen marriage is to guarantee the right of divorce. I see the discussant has got the point. The OAU had two provisions in the Charter, the old Organization of African Unity. One provision said, the right of all peoples to self-determination. The other said, sovereignty of all states. Most writers on the OAU said these provisions were contradictory. They contradicted one another. I don't think so. I think actually, sovereignty and self-determination go together. Self-determination is about a relationship between the people and power. Sovereignty is a relationship between different powers. Self-determination is an internal relation of the state to the people. Now, there are two great examples of self-determination. If you look at the period since independence, there are two great examples of self-determination. Two great examples of the creation of new states out of independent African states. One is Eritrea, and the other is South Sudan. I think it's interesting to compare these two. But first, recognize this much. To my knowledge, no state in history has agreed to being split up into several components. None. Whether democratic or authoritarian. Every state in history has fought tooth and nail to prevent secession. Think of the American Civil War. Millions died. Millions. Think of the division of India and Pakistan. So, secession, the creation of a new state out of an existing state, presents us with a puzzle, with a challenge. We need to explain how come this came to be, because it doesn't happen normally. Take the example of Eritrea. Eritrean self-determination, in my view, was the outcome of two important developments, one internal, the other external. The internal development was that the power in Ethiopia was defeated. The Derg was militarily defeated by two liberation movements, two armed movements, one based in Ethiopia, the other in Eritrea. Together, they defeated the Derg. So the internal condition was military defeat of the Derg. The external condition was the end of the Cold War. Because the Cold War had ended, the US was relatively more open to new arrangements. It didn't think of the rise of a new state as a possible fifth column Trojan horse ally of the Soviet Union. There was a referendum after the defeat of the war. The two movements, the Eritrean and the Ethiopian ones, came to power. They were close allies, and they said the people will decide. And they had a referendum, secession or unity. In spite of the very close relationship between the two movements, the people in question, the people in Eritrea, voted for independence, overwhelmingly. Shift to South Sudan. Anybody with the knowledge of Eritrea would have known in advance that if there was a referendum in South Sudan, the people would vote overwhelmingly for independence. And yet, the government in Khartoum agreed to sign the CPA in 2005, which had in its clauses a provision for a referendum in South Sudan. Why did it agree to this? What were the conditions that led to this agreement? Let's look at both the internal and the external factors. Internally, there was no military victory. It was not like Eritrea. The power in Khartoum was not defeated militarily. Internally, there was a military stalemate between both sides. So given a stalemate, why would the government in Khartoum agree to a referendum in the south? This question hasn't really been discussed. My answer is provisional. I think in the case of South Sudan, the decisive factor was external. And the external factor was USA and the war on terror post 9/11. The US had already invaded Iraq, Afghanistan, It had bombed a pharmaceutical factory in Khartoum in the Clinton period before 9/11, and the government in Khartoum was scared to death that it would be next on the list of American targets. Signing the agreement was deferring a confrontation with the US by another 6 years. So let's move on to the meaning of independence. How are we to understand it? You know, if you shift back to Ethiopia and Eritrea, many Eritrean nationalists in that period used to write of the relationship between Ethiopia and Eritrea as a colonial relationship. What they wrote was not entirely wrong, but what they wrote missed an important point. And the important point was this. The colonial power in the classical sense at independence, its officialdom leaves. They retreat to Britain or to France. Their interests remain, but they retreat. But Eritrea and Ethiopia, like South and North Sudan, are neighbors. You can run away from a marriage, but you can't run away from your neighbors. Even after death, you're still neighbors. How do you negotiate neighborhood? And how do you think the history of neighborhood? That's what I'd like to do here, is to try and put the relationship between North and South Sudan, two geographical neighbors, into a larger context, because their relationship was not simply shaped by geography, the fact that they were next to one another, but this geography actually gave rise to overlapping histories. They were part of one another in different ways. What were the critical ways? I'd like to highlight some of the key points in that history, because it challenges the version that we hold today. It challenges the version of the North as Arab and Muslim, with Arabs having come from someplace else, the South as Christian and animist, and African. It challenges this version. And I'd like to just put forth a few questions so that we can begin to think about it. This history begins with the history of migrations. And there are two kinds of migrations, voluntary migration and forced migration. Let's begin with voluntary migration. This is migration in the period before colonialism. It's migration in the period before slavery. There are two big states. Today, if you ask people in northern Sudan especially to tell you their history, they will tell you, they will think of their history as beginning from the 15th century, 16th century, from the rise of two big sultanates. One on the Nile, the Sultanate of the Fanj, with its capital at Sinar. The other in western Sudan, the Sultanate of Darfur. Darfur and Sinar, two sultanates. Before those sultanates, both Darfur and Sinar were Islamic sultanates. Before them, the power in the north was Christian. That history goes back to the pharaohs, 6,000 years of history. Now, the interesting point is this. The bigger of the two sultanates, the Sultanate of the Fanj, the Sultanate at Sinar, is set up by a migration from the south. The royal house of the Sinar, the royal house of the Fanj, comes from the Shilluk people who migrate from the south to the north and set up this kingdom. If we understand Sinar, if we understand the power of the Fanj as the first Islamic state in Sudan, it was set up by southerners, not by northerners. In fact, it brought to an end Christian states in the north. So it's not a simple history. Islam in the north was mainly refugees and merchants. Islam as a political power was in its origin a southern development. Second, involuntary migration, slavery. Slavery begins with these two states, large-scale slavery in a sense. Sinnar, Darfur. It begins in the 17th century. But it expands phenomenally in the 18th century. Towards late 18th century, plantation slavery, which is how we think of slavery. As a system, plantation slavery is transported from the Caribbean, from the West Indies, to the Indian Ocean. The French get a number of colonies in the Indian Ocean. The Réunion, Mauritius, Madagascar. They begin to change these colonies into plantation colonies. And there's a huge demand for slave labor. The capture of slaves expands all along the East African coast. Before that, most of the slaves gotten in South Sudan, because the slaves in this part we know today as Sudan, are captured in South Sudan. The capture is mainly done by armies coming from these two sultanates, Fanj and Darfur. They capture the slaves, most of these slaves become soldiers. There are no plantations. Very few, like Iraq in the 4th century, but really, it's by and large, most of them become soldiers. They are slave soldiers. What happens to these slaves who become slave soldiers in Darfur, become slave soldiers in Sinnar? Those in Darfur, over time, they become poor. And those in Sinnar, around the Nile, over time, they become Arabs. Some of the Arabs in North Sudan are descendants of slaves from the south. This is the second important point to keep in mind. There is no single history of Arabs. What are called Arabs in North Sudan come from different histories. One of those histories is that their grandparents were slaves. It's like Americans of African origin. They came as slaves to the US. Over time, through a combination of coercion and consent, they became culturally Westerners. So that African Americans today are part of Western civilization. Slightly similar history. Then we come to the period of nationalism. This is another period where it's difficult to separate out the North and the South. The big moment of nationalism in Sudan is the revolt of the Mahdi. Towards late 19th century, the Mahdiya, a movement led by the Mahdi, aimed against Ottoman and British rule, which succeeds in defeating British Ottoman power and creates a state. The Mahdiya creates for the first time a political unity in what we call North Sudan. But not just that, the Mahdiya also spreads, particularly to Abyei, to the Dinka of Abyei. The Dinka say that the spirit of Deng has caught the Mahdi. The Dinka joined the Mahdi. That's the first counter to an enforced enslavement of the south from the north. Now, for the first time, a movement that opposes imperialism where the south, parts of the south, take part. Then comes the event which is known as the birth of official nationalism, of nationalism in Sudan. That's the White Flag Revolt in the 1920s. It is led by southern officers. Nationalism in Sudan begins as a movement led by officers in the colonial army from the south. It is then that Britain decides to separate the North and the South administratively, to create a situation where you cannot cross boundaries unless you have permits to do so. Nothing unusual. The same was the situation in Uganda, where, for example, Karamoja was created quarantined. The Karamojong couldn't leave the place without permission, and you could not go to Karamoja without permission. But, and this is the main point, although North and South were artificially separated under colonialism, it didn't really give rise to a movement for the independence of the South. It gave rise to a movement for representation for the South in an independent Sudan. The movement for an independent South Sudan has its origins in the period after independence, not the period before independence. This is important for one reason. For southern peoples, the worst period, worse than colonialism, was the period after independence. It's in the period after independence that successive regimes in the north decide that they want to create a nation. And they decide that the best way to create a nation is by force. Decide that the best way to create a nation is to get everybody to speak the same language, Arabic. And so a program of forced Arabization. When it fails, they decide the best way to create a nation is to spread Islam. Not by conviction, but by force. A period of forced Islamization. It's in that period that the response in the South to the experience of independence begins to diversify. And yet, the main response is still not for an independent South Sudan. The main response is still for a united Sudan, reformed. It's not for an independent state, it's for a reformed state. When SPLA is born, think of it. S in SPLA stands for Sudan, not South Sudan. Sudan. P stands for peoples in the singular, not in the plural. There's no claim that there are many peoples inside Sudan. The claim is that Sudan and the people who live in it are a single people. Sudan People's Liberation Army. Sudan in the singular, people in the singular. That's SPLA at its birth. Read Garang's speech at Kokadam. Mansur Khalid put together a set of Garang's speeches. It's published as a book. One of those speeches is a speech to the opposition movement at Kokadam. And Garang tells them, my objective is a new Sudan, a reformed Sudan. My objective is not an independent South Sudan. It's an interesting speech to read. Now the question is this. How come it changed? How come it changed? When Garang signed the CPA, 2005, and he returned to Khartoum, when he landed in Khartoum, I knew you were coming to tell me that I have only 5 minutes left. She's not wearing a uniform, but I can fear. Garang came to Sudan, came to Khartoum in 2005. When he landed in Khartoum, there was a massive crowd of over 1 million people. They represented the entire diversity of Sudan, northerners, southerners, easterners, westerners. Everybody was there. The political class in Khartoum was shocked How could this man from the south attract this massive crowd? People who pinned their hopes on him. How could this be? Journalists wrote that the only other event they had seen similar to it was Mugabe landing in Harare. When Mugabe landed in Harare, when the settlers were defeated, the British were shocked by million plus people in Harare, turned up from all over the country. The scene was similar. In my view, if the SPLA had fought, had contested the elections of 2010, they would have won. They would have won. The only force that could have defeated the NCP in that election, the only force that could have united the opposition around it in a successful bid was SPLA. But SPLA decided not to fight, not to contest the election. Why? Part of the reason, I think, but only part of the reason. One part is leadership, change of leadership. Garang died before the election. If you think of the history of liberation movements, you are struck by one thing. The key military political leader is often killed at the hour of victory. Tom Mugara was killed in Zimbabwe. Chris Hani was killed in South Africa. The death of Garang happened soon after he got to Khartoum. There's some similarities between the SPLA and the ANC. In both cases, you had a political leadership that included, in the case of the ANC, it included whites, not just blacks. It included people like Joe Slovo, people like Ronnie Kasrael. And in the case of SPLA, it included people like Mansour Khalid, people like Yasir Arman, who was to be their presidential candidate, but then dropped out. So that's one, leadership. But I don't think leadership is sufficient explanation. There's a second explanation, experience. The experience of power sharing. The first power sharing arrangement was in 1972, after the Addis Ababa Agreement. The North and South agreed to share power. But the sharing was of political positions. The politics in the South was reformed. The state structure in the South was reformed. In the North, it wasn't reformed. So there was political support for it in the North was lukewarm. And when the Northern government found the agreement was no longer convenient, it dropped it. So the South learned a lesson from this. The lesson it learned was that power sharing in 1972 was too narrow. When it came time for power sharing in 2005, they said we must broaden this power sharing. The power sharing must not only be about political positions, the power sharing must also be about money. We divide the old revenue into half. You take half, we keep half. The power sharing must also be about weapons. We keep our army, you keep your army. But there's one point about the power sharing we need to keep in mind. The power sharing was between two parties in power, NCP in the North and SPLA in the South. The opposition was excluded in both the North and in the South. The power sharing was between two powers. The power sharing did not include democratization. That's the main problem with the power sharing between the North and the South. It's the main problem with the process which gives birth to an independent South Sudan. So let me come to my last question. What would democratization mean in the present context? Is there a link between democratization and violence and peace? And if so, what's the link? Well, first, if we think of civil peace, we need to keep in mind that the first prerequisite of civil peace is not democratization. The first prerequisite of civil peace is simply a functioning state. It's simply civil power. Think of Uganda, 1986. The NRA comes to Kampala, okay? What's the situation? The NRA comes to Kampala, the situation is that NRA is simply the largest of the militias. The most successful militia, the strongest militia, the best organized militia, and probably the militia with the most sort of political sense of forces and possibilities. But it's not the only armed power, there are others. There's UFM, there's FEDEMO, there are others. What does the NRA do? The NRA says, okay, you, whether you are FEDEMO, UFM, you are Moses Ali from Amin's former group, you can join the broad base. We'll give you political positions, we'll give you ministries. You can join the broad base. But give up your arms. Give up your arms. You can keep your political objectives, but give up the military means. Give up the militias. And you can have a share in political power, maybe not positions. What happened in South Sudan? In South Sudan, the members of the broad base have kept their arms and they've kept their militias. Every important leader, political leader in the SPLM has his own militia. So what happens if you lose an election? What happens if you lose your ministerial position? Then you leave with your militia. What happens then? Last week, there was the incident, the case of General George Athor, who had lost the election for governor of Jonglei State, last April's election. He went into rebellion. He attacked Malacca at the heart of the oil-producing areas. The SPLM, Paganamon, said, this is a northern plot. We are suspending discussions with the north. But that's not the real point. The real point is, even if there's a northern plot, it couldn't have existed without General Athor. It required a General Athor. In other words, General Athor and his rebellion, Athor was not part of SPLM, he was an independent candidate in the election. But General Athor's rebellion is a warning signal. What happens if a commander in the SPLM loses an election and leaves with his militia? What next? Now let me come to the question of political violence. How much time can I take? Five. There are four of you there. Each one is saying five, so it's 20. I'll stick to five. Five, seven. Right. So, the question of political violence is this. In most African countries, political violence is not between states. Political violence in most African countries is inside states, within states. The only exceptions, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Uganda, Rwanda. The only exceptions are where the political power was nurtured in the womb of a neighboring state and became the power in an independent country. That's the India-Pakistan situation. You have an India-Pakistan situation between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Will we have an India-Pakistan situation between South Sudan and North Sudan? But in all of these cases, there is still internal violence. And this is the half point of the lecture, but I'm going to put it very briefly. And this is the main point that I want to make. Where does this internal violence come from? Think of Rift Valley in Kenya. Okay? Rift Valley in Kenya, you had an uprising in the White Highlands, Mau Mau. The British ended Mau Mau by distributing land to those who collaborated with them on the highlands. And then the Mau Mau guerrillas, they brought them down the mountain and they gave them land in the Rift Valley. Now, you have a land question in the Rift Valley. One group says in the Rift Valley, this is our land. The other group says, no, it's our land. One group says it's our land because this is our tribal land, because it was declared our tribal land in the colonial period. The other group says, no, it's our land because we are citizens of Kenya and we bought this land. There are two rights: right of citizenship, right of tribal homeland. The right of tribal homeland is anchored in the colonial period. The right of citizenship is anchored in the period after colonialism, the independence period. But both are right. Neither is wrong in this sense. Right? The fact that both are right point out to us that we have not yet managed to come clean with the colonial record. We have not yet managed to confront the colonial legacy adequately. Who does the land belong to? What is the nature of citizenship? Is it tribal, ethnic in the local area, or is it national? When I studied the question in Darfur, it was the same problem. Look at Ivory Coast, same problem. Look at Uganda, you will see the same problem in different parts of the country. Will South Sudan manage to create a way out of this? If you look at the record, because SPLM controlled different areas since the armed struggle began, they were liberated areas. If you look at how the liberated areas were run, it is no different from how government-controlled areas were run. Liberated areas in South Sudan are now being administered as series of tribal homelands, very similar to the new system in Uganda over the last several years. If you run a place as a tribal homeland, but the population is multi-ethnic from different places, you end up discriminating against one group and in favor of another group. That's a recipe for ethnic conflict. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Professor Hamdan, it's not very easy for me to keep flashing the light of time, but...